Welcome back to Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron on News Talk 580 CFRA and the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome back. This is Ottawa Now. I'm Andrew Pinson in for Christy Cameron on this warmest June 1st in Ottawa history. Text us how you're staying cool. 580, 580. You can also tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. Today, June 1st, also kicking off Stroke Month. Heart and Stroke Canada releasing a new report today looking at some of the gaps in aftercare and particularly support for women in Canada after they've experienced a stroke. And joining us to chat about this is Janet Millen, an Ottawa woman who suffered a stroke herself. She's currently dealing with a number of issues, including aphasia. Janet, thanks so much for joining us today and for sharing your story.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to tell my story. It's very important.
And it seems like women are kind of falling through the gaps here. According to this report, 20 to 70% women are more likely to experience post-stroke depression compared to men, and more likely to experience post-stroke anxiety as well. So that's on the mental health aspect. But when it comes to aphasia, maybe just explain what you're dealing with right now.
I suffer from aphasia, which is a communication disorder. There are four aspects of it that are very, very, when they're lost, very difficult. There's speaking, writing, listening, and the other fourth one. There's four. Well, all of them of language are so important. I'm very lucky. Well, speaking is the other one. I don't worry about that. I can speak very well, but the other three are very, very difficult. And that means I've lost a lot of my ability to connect with friends, even my family, and any work that I was retired, but I had a theater company, and I lost that. So there was a lot of aspects of depression and loss, and some of the things, they will never come back. And I had the type of stroke that I had, hemorrhagic stroke. The front lobe of my brain was basically removed through surgery. So nothing can be the same.
For yourself, I know you mentioned you're kind of now officially retired, but you also used to be a teacher as well. Kind of that communications aspect, how important is that to you just in terms of, you know, how you've built relationships and your career?
Oh, it was just crucial, you know, and why would I get hit by that? Because it was a passion of my life, was language. I was a drama teacher and taught the aspect of the language of English, and writing with kids as well. It just, all of that was gone. So the professional loss, as I say, I was retired, but I still did a lot of things anyway, volunteer, all those things, and they just go. And it's so very difficult to try to get back. So I had to change my life completely, and I couldn't go forward. I had to go sideways. So I would do things very, very differently. So one thing I was having a lot of conversations and helping people who were disabled, but then I would have one-to-one meetings with other people who were suffering from aphasia. It would either the victim or the carer. So I was very able to, it was very meaningful for me to help them. And I did a lot of presentations at universities and colleges and schools and book clubs, you know, just involved as much as I can. And it also helps my own ability to keep speaking and keep learning again. I had to start all over again, like a child, like a four-year-old. So I lost a lot of my own confidence and my ability to do the things that I love to do. I just start all over.
And, you know, it seems based on, you know, your life and passions that you are very committed to the idea of hanging on to communication in that aspect. So, being aware of it, I'm sure, kind of helps you to address it in some ways. But I guess we talk about some of the gaps for particularly women who are trying to get care post-stroke. What have you kind of noticed so far in your journey through the system to healing?
I think where there are some problems, and I was in about 2.5 months in hospital and rehab, and what was missing was just emotional support then. And that was 16 years ago. All the doctors and the nurses and everybody else was working there. Absolutely wonderful people who gave me a lot of support and confidence that I would get back. But there was no emotional. That had to come from outside of the system, except for one social worker who helped me quite a bit, and a speech pathologist that she was also quite amazing as well. But it was just not in the system. I'd had to find it out for myself. And I also, my husband, women lose their husbands. They just don't have the ability to live them together anymore. They don't really get it, how to manage and just be able to move in a different way. And my husband is very much able to do that. He's a social worker and he's an advocate. And he was there to make sure that I got everything I possibly could get. So I was very lucky. And two sons in their 20s when this happened, and they were also very supportive. But in the system was emotional support, mental health. You had to go finding it out somewhere else from that time exactly when I was there.
I'm so happy to hear that you've had a solid support system during all of this. I guess if you did not have that support system or your own strong advocacy from yourself and your family, do you feel like it would be easy for somebody kind of going through this to kind of fall through the gaps?
I think a lot. Yes, I was just reading an article today of a very young woman who had a stroke, 2001 maybe, but she was such a young person then and just somehow definitely fell through the cracks. And she was so terrified what had happened and what her problem at that moment was, that she did not have enough knowledge about what a stroke is and she suffers from aphasia, she has other issues, but she just didn't even know what it was how she would have to go through. There was not enough learning to put that in the education system, I guess, but more heart and stroke and just what are the basics of how the body's going to work and why strokes happen the way they do and the difference between the one I had and somebody else's has. There's so much information needed there. So I think educational assistant in Ontario, at least we would start getting another aspect to it, to the kids have to understand what I know they tell them about the fast, but it's maybe not quite enough, and especially dealing with their parents and grandparents who may get very ill and don't really know what to do. They try, but I think there's got to be more of it.
Yeah, and we can see how that understanding is so key to kind of finding help and moving forward. Jenna, we'll leave it there just because of time, but thank you so much for sharing your story with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much, and I hope that it was meaningful for anyone else who's able to listen.
It was for me, so I have no doubt that it was moving for our listeners as well. But thank you, Janet. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Janet Millen, Ottawa woman, suffered a hemorrhagic stroke, back in 2006. Kind of talk about some of the gaps. An incredible, incredible work, obviously, to get to the point where she can communicate so clearly, dealing with aphasia herself. But today, kicking off Stroke Month, Heart and Stroke releasing a new report looking at some of the gaps in care, particularly for women here in Canada.
Just dancing with my eyes closed, 'cause everywhere I look, I still
Take us with you on your Apple CarPlay or Android Auto through your iHeartRadio app. It's Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron on News Talk 580 CFRA and the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
And welcome back. It is 3:24 here on Ottawa Now. I'm Andrew Pinson for Christy Cameron on this scorcher of a Thursday afternoon. Heat warning still in effect through to Saturday. Get a bit of a reprieve. But Texas, how you're beating the heat? Your best tips. 580-580. Tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. Well, why catch your food when you can print it? An Israeli food tech company says it's 3D printed the first ever ready-to-cook fish fillet using animal cells that have been cultivated and grown in a laboratory. Joining us to talk about that is Dan Riskin, CTV Science and Technology Specialist. I don't know if he's a food connoisseur now. Dan, thanks so much for joining us.
What did you say? Why catch a fish when you can print it? I like that. Yeah, that should be their tagline. I think that really works.
Yeah, I need to have a nap after something like that. But it's just when
that's
you see
heat dogging. That's the heat dogging.
When you see something like this, though, I know it turns people off in a sense of we're starting to think about it so futuristic. But when we look at this, is this a way to kind of talk about the food insecurity stuff that we've been chatting about for some time?
This is listen, I'm a huge fan of this idea of lab grown meat. I think it's the way forward. I really think it's the way to go. Although I will say, like, fish is always the meat that's like, if there's any question about whether this is good meat or bad meat, fish is like the first thing I walk away from. Like, that's just too, the stakes are too high, because you eat some bad fish and you're going to have a very bad time. But this is what they did, is they took stem cells from groupers, which of course is a fish that you can eat. And then they used those stem cells in the lab to grow muscle cells, which then also produced fats. And so then you've got muscle tissue and fats that are made from the DNA of a grouper. So they're the same, at least they should be the same. And then they basically made it into this goo. I'm not really selling it here, but they made it into a goo that you can 3D print with, a bio ink, they call it. And then it comes out of an extruder. And just like I don't know if you've ever looked at a 3D printer, basically what they have is this plastic inside them that comes out of a little nozzle. And then they lay down layers of this stuff, and eventually it makes something out of plastic as it dries. What you'd have instead of the plastic would be this goo, this bio ink, which is made up of the proteins and the fats of fish, which should be the exact same proteins and fats that occur in real fish. And then that is laid out into the shape of a fish fillet. Now, people have eaten this. There was a big, the two companies are from Israel and Singapore. They had a big thing in Israel, and apparently the prime minister of Israel sat down and ate some of this stuff. So people have eaten it, and people say, but they work for the company, people say that it's just like the real thing. I would like to try it to know if it really is like the real thing, because I'm not so sure that this bio ink extruded goo laid out into the shape of a fish fillet is going to quite cut it. But anyway, I'm excited about it as a technology that's developing. I don't know if I would get excited about eating this particular fish.
Yeah, it's very interesting when you put it like that in terms of the bio ink. When we kind of talk about animals, we've seen this before, chicken and beef kind of more specifically, but I guess why is it so much harder to, I guess, copy fish cells than it is cows and chickens?
Yeah, I don't think it's a matter of it being harder. I think it's just a matter of just applying this to different things. And a right. lot of people like to eat fish. You know, people of the Catholic faith, of course, fish is important in that for that culture. But there are a lot of other cultures around the world where fish is really important. And also, sometimes there are endangered species that people really want to eat. And that doesn't make them bad people. It's just that this is the culture they bring with them. And the earth is kind of straining under the weight of all these people right now. So what if you could grow the meat of an endangered species from its DNA? You wouldn't have to take any of them out of the wild. And so what's great about this technology is that you can do it without harming animals. You can do it without having to fish, like go and have bycatch and accidentally catch a dolphin and all those other problems that happen when you try to catch fish. You would also have the advantage that you would reduce all the carbon that comes out when you send a ship out to sea and it catches fish and brings it back, and then it goes in a truck and it has to stay frozen. All that stuff goes away. You'd save 95% of the carbon emissions compared to traditional fish. You save 60% compared to aquaculture. These are numbers that come from the company itself, so I'll put that caveat on there. But you know, there's no question that it would be better from an environmental perspective. You would use fewer resources, and you could still have your meat. And I think the thing is that, you know, just telling the whole world that it's time to for everybody to become a vegetarian because we just don't have enough planet for everyone to eat meat, that's just not going to fly. Like, people are not interested in that messaging, and people are not going to adopt it, and it's just going to make the value of meat go up when it's there's that kind of a pressure. So this is a way for people to be able to enjoy the foods that they want to have, although a slightly different version of it, but in a way that that works. And I think the environmental side of this is great. For a lot of people, it's the animal welfare side that makes this so exciting. But it's definitely worth going farther down the road on this. And you know, maybe we haven't quite hit the palatable version of it yet, but I think it's worth looking to see if we can do this.
No pun intended, for sure. But we'll leave it there. Dan, thanks so much for your time and perspective on this. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Making 3D printed fish more palatable. That's what we're trying to do here. Would you eat a 3D printed fish?
Fishy, fishy, fishy!
And then you just click the play button, the print button, and then it's there.
I've never felt more the opposite of hungry in my whole life.
Whatever that is. You know, that's what I was actually, and just because we ran out of time, and we still don't have time, but I'm going to ask you about it anyway. Just the PR aspect of this, right? It seems like it makes sense, right? But just convincing people to have this 3D printed fish might be kind of more the issue than anything else.
Yeah, I think it's just a matter of, I don't know, change of mindset. I don't know. But right now, my mind's not going there. If I had to, obviously I'd have to eat it. But like, I just don't like fish in general. I'm not a fish person. But,
as Dan kind of mentioned, they didn't really kind of do this with fish. It was other animals. There's a reason why, right?
Yeah.
It's already kind of harder to sell.
If someone tries to give me salmon or fish sticks, I'm like, no, thank you. But if we were... You know, if I was absolutely destitute and the only thing to eat was a fish, yeah, I'd have to stomach it. So I'm guessing that would be my take.
Barbecue salmon. Yeah. That's what we could use tonight because it's so hot outside. We'll leave it there. Would you eat a 3D printed fish or other animal? Let us know. Text us 580-580. Tweet us at CFO Ottawa. We'll take a quick break here for the news. We'll be right back. This is News Talk 580 CFRA.
This is News Talk 580 CFRA. Baby, show me you can calm down, dance. Welcome back to Ottawa Now with Christy Cameron on News Talk 580 CFRA and the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome back, 3:39. This is Ottawa Now. I'm Andrew Pinson in for Christy Cameron. I've been asking, how have you been beating the heat, or how are you beating this very early heat wave? You can text us 580-580. But Mike, putting some perspective on this in Vanier. Beat the heat? Are you nuts? It's going to be winter again before you know it. Enjoy the heat. Embrace the heat. Be the heat. It's a good point. We'll get to some of those coming up a little bit later as well. Also, Tell All Thursday coming up just before 4 o'clock. Matt Scooby going to join us. New study. At Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center in Toronto has found that dosing errors in children increased during the Canada-wide shortage of pediatric fever and pain medication last year. Joining us to talk about that is Jonathan Sapersky, a clinical pharmacologist and toxicologist at the Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center. He is the lead author on this study. And Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Sapersky.
Thanks so much for having me.
When I think about this just off the cuff, it does kind of defy logic a little bit, in a sense, if we didn't have a lot, but there were more calls for dosing issues and people kind of having too much. I guess, where do you square the circle here?
Yeah, I mean, it may sound a bit counterintuitive right off the bat, but the way we sort of understood this was that at the time that there was a drug shortage in the fall and winter of 2022, major organizations and hospitals also put out recommendations on how to divide adult doses or repurpose adult doses to give to children. So we hypothesized that maybe some of that guidance was associated with dosing errors, and perhaps irrespective of that guidance, which was obviously well-intentioned, parents or caregivers might have been dividing doses by themselves and making errors.
And I guess when it comes to, you know, things that we're talking about, generally acetaminophen and ibuprofen, is there a danger involved with having improper dosage for children on those medications?
So that's a tough question to answer. Every situation is unique. And so sometimes, you know, taking too much of a drug is obviously dangerous and it can lead to a poisoning and some harm. But again, every situation is unique, and children often require smaller doses of medication. Like, they're not just small adults. They need doses based on weight and age. And that's why we have special formulations for kids. And some of our work speaks to the importance of my colleagues at the Ontario Poison Center and other poison centers across the country, that because every situation requires specialized intervention, that if there is an improper dose given, to call one of these poison centers and get special advice about what to do in your unique situation.
And everybody can understand how unique every person is as well. So I'm sure those situations can be stressful, no doubt. When it comes to, some of the other issues with dosing for kids, because I was reading that this is just kind of a small part of the problem, this issue with dosing. How much bigger is the larger issue on a general basis without this shortage?
Can you clarify the question again?
Just in general, sorry, clumsily worded, but just the idea of this kind of popping up because of the shortages that we have here. You were looking at that, but looking at the study as well, it talks about the drug shortage and how that was just kind of one small part of the problem when it comes to dosaging. Am I reading that right?
The study mostly looked at the drug shortage, that period of between August and December where there was a shortage, and compared it to the dosing errors that we typically see at baseline from the about four and a half years prior to that. We saw a substantial increase in calls about dosing errors to the poison center at that time. And I think the other important takeaway from the study is that we didn't actually see that there was an increased referral into hospitals. We didn't see that there were more patients, more children being referred into hospital for serious poisonings, which was reassuring. But I think that's sort of the tip of the iceberg here. We actually don't know how much, how many dosing errors occurred in the entire population or how much harm that might have caused.
Gotcha. I understand now. And in that aspect, when it comes to, just regularly giving your kids dosages of medications, is it best to be conservative, you know, go low and slow in that aspect?
For sure. I mean, most formulations of children's medications come with specific labeling about how to dose them. And oftentimes kids are not taking pills, they're taking chewables or they're taking liquid formulations. So parents or caregivers have to draw up the medication and administer to kids based on their weight and based on their age. And those dosing instructions are pretty clear. And in Canada, those are usually in English and French. And I think part of the challenge was that, some parents, like I know I'm a parent with two young kids, and we were in the same position, and we were trying to source drugs from elsewhere, like the United States, and sometimes not just from the United States but from other countries, dosing, concentrations of drugs or dosing instructions may be different. So it's something to watch out for, right, if you as you're dosing medications for your kids.
Yeah, I'm even thinking, the metric system versus imperial system could have an impact, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and I mean, it sort of speaks to the importance of, if you also don't, if the dosing is confusing for you and you're trying to figure out how to give the safest possible dose to your child and you need some help, please reach out to doctors or pharmacists or other healthcare providers who can certainly give you information on what the safest dose is and how to make some of those conversions if they're confusing.
No, definitely good information to get out there. And Dr. Sapersky, thanks so much for your time and your perspective on this and your work on this. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me this afternoon.
Dr. Sapersky, Dr. Jonathan Sapersky, is a clinical pharmacologist, toxicologist at the Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center, lead author of the study as well. So just raising some concerns during the drug shortage that we were kind of giving people or children higher doses. So we had more calls to poison control centers. As he did mention, though, on the good news front, is that we didn't see a rise in hospital admissions. But something to be aware of is you give your kids medication, particularly it's ibuprofen and acetaminophen that have been the biggest problems during the course of this drug shortage, which has been waning now, I should say. 3:45.
I'll have a confession to make too.
Really?
Listen.
Tell All Thursday on News Talk 580 CFRA.
Hot beats, hot temperatures. Joining us in the studio is CTV's Matt Scooby.
What's up, Annie?
This is just
hot beats.
Yeah, like, right? No, I know. I had a Matt Scooby feel when I heard this song come on.
Vibing on this very hot Thursday.
It's very hot Thursday. What are you doing to vibe? I heard you were Doing something in the back park?
Yeah, there may be a bit of a weather experiment happening that may involve eggs right now.
Stay tuned for 6.
Tune in to CTV News at 6 and we'll and or the CTV Ottawa TikTok account that might be on there too for updates.
It's also a Morning Lies food segment tomorrow, yeah. I think. Yeah.
In an ideal world, but we are not living in an ideal world. So
I've been asking people just how they've been kind of beating the heat. A couple of people getting on me just, you know, it's winter for so long here.
Mm-hmm.
Let's not complain about the heat.
True.
Definitely not. I don't think I'm complaining about it, but definitely how do you beat it? Do you have a
it's tip? Extreme.
It
it's
is.
Extreme.
It is.
Like this
very
is extreme for this early in the year, too.
That's what I was kind of mentioning was I was even out for a run last night and we were chatting with Ottawa Public Health earlier. Was your body's not adjusted quite yet?
Exactly.
So just, you know, it hits you a little bit harder. So something to be aware of. But do you have a tip or a trick? Air conditioning?
Air conditioning is always a good thing for sure. And if you don't have air conditioning, finding a place that has air conditioning, if you can, like a mall or otherwise, is always the best bet. There was a story, and it's maybe not a tip or a trick, but there was a story that I got to do a few years ago. Well, actually, probably a number of years ago now. When it was a hot out, fun heat story going, like, how do you beat the heat?
Yeah.
So I went to my cameraman's pool at the time. So we went and jumped in his pool, clearly, right? That helps.
Great assignment.
Jumping in the water.
Yeah.
Not a good thing. Then we went to a public pool, you know, where I had some kids butt in front of me in line and may or may not have been prearranged, but just to have some fun with that.
Yeah.
And the one kid was way too into it, which was great for TV purposes, so that was fun. And then the third one, maybe a little bit unorthodox, is that we went to a butcher shop, found a meat cooler and a meat fridge, hopped in there for a few minutes. And that was lovely to cool off, let me tell you. So I'm not going to advocate going to try and find a massive freezer or a fridge, but let me tell you.
If you stumble across one.
It did the trick. So, yeah.
It's actually my first job was actually at the butcher shop at the grocery store in the town that I grew up in. And I did notice that in the summer, right? You spent all day in that cooler and that freezer, and then you went outside, and it's so weird for the body
to reacclimate. Such a big change. I mean, even like when I was I used to be a bartender in Toronto too, and I was going to school, and just going into the big like produce fridge just to kind of we had air conditioning, but at times when it's so cold, and you're like, oh my god,
I'm just gonna stay in here so for nice. Like an hour.
Yeah,
but tell all Thursday. Let's see here, Danny. We were talking about something that you do. Knowing that it will annoy someone or people, but you do it anyway because you want to annoy them. And as somebody with two brothers, I think I can definitely relate with this. Anybody with kind of siblings can understand.
The oldest of four.
You're just kidding. So, yeah. King of annoying.
Yeah. I feel like younger siblings are always more annoying, right?
But
there are a certain number of things that I've picked up.
Do you pass that along to your wife? Does she take that now?
And
the siblings are gone. Do you do annoying things to her now?
No, I don't. She doesn't really. She doesn't have time for it. She doesn't put up with it too. She hates to be tickled. Right. That's probably the thing. Like when I have boys. Like boys are 4 and 2, and so they know. And listen, you talk about like my body and like when they say stop, like stop. But like I can be bad for tickling sometimes, especially with them. Where it's just kind of like sometimes it's funny and they're into it. Other times it's like no, get out of here. But I'm gonna do it regardless. My other one for me is also scaring. Right. Unless I really know that someone is like doesn't handle it well. And there have been a couple of people, especially at 87 George here in the Bell Media building, that just they don't deal well with it. But if I know that you're somewhat okay with it or I'm not going to get punched in the face by it, like it can be annoying and I'm not going to be like assaulted, which is not necessarily, an unheard of reaction or unjustified given that I might be scaring the bleep out of you. But because this is the thing. When you have siblings, and especially if you're a younger sibling, when you know it bothers someone, that's what you do.
You're
right?
Doing more.
It's like
absolutely.
The nicknames for my sister. Like, I'm not going to say it on the air because she'd actually kill me. But like, brothers, like, and I have two younger brothers, so she's the only girl. But when we had, there were a bunch of different nicknames that all got rolled into one. And it was, from a number of different incidents. And she would just used to be like, yep. And you just see her face. Sometimes. And we still pull it out every now and then.
You just know what drives them nuts,
right?
That's the thing.
Right.
You know what buttons to push.
Exactly.
But the scaring thing, no, I'm glad I haven't been a victim of you yet. I don't know. Just sometimes if you're close enough, I'm the flailer, right? It's like, oh my God, I'm going to just punch you for no reason at all.
Right.
But no, for some reason, even into this, I remember just because I was dancing family a few weeks ago. We do this thing scaring where it's just like at the back door of my mom's house. It's the same thing. Like almost every time I'm down, somebody at some point jumps up and scares somebody. Somebody
right.
gets kicked.
Exactly.
Somebody's yelling. It's just, I don't know why. I just haven't let it go still.
Right. And that's going to be part of it. Like my brother and I used to have the brother's closest to me. He's 15 months younger than me. Adam, for those that might know my brother, but we literally he got the time wrong of my hockey game once. He hid in the cupboard that's right by where we used to keep our hockey gear, and he was there for an hour and 15 minutes because he was there an hour earlier than he thought. He was going to wait for a few minutes to scare me. He waited in the dark in this cupboard where our hockey gear was in the basement for over an hour and just kept, and clearly lost track of time and just didn't care. And he got me, but it was my scare reflex is you have to get me really good in order for me to jump now because I've been conditioned for this for a long time. But that's to the point of epicness where it's that's going to happen. So
I am so proud of his commitment to the
play. Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 It was
over an hour.
It was quite a long time. He said that he waited there. So.
He knew as soon as he left, you were going to come, so he wasn't going to leave.
Yeah.
So I don't have any siblings. I'm an only child.
It's probably for the best for your nerves. Probably, but yeah.
But Jeremy Sharon tried to scare me last week.
Oh, yeah?
I had no reaction. And
serial killer wise.
Yeah.
No reaction.
His question was, oh, my God, what is wrong with you?
Yeah. but that's the same
not
with
him.
Yeah.
No,
that's the same.
Me.
It's the same with Jackie Paris, one of my colleagues downstairs at CTV. Literally, I think that I can be very sneaky when I have to be, in the fact trying to avoid people's eye contacts, because if someone looks at you while you're going behind them, it gives it away a lot of the time, or just being very, very quiet. Ask our director Marlene Pauly, who's downstairs. She's been scared a number of times. And so I can be poor Marlene. Right. There's been a lot of different scares. Someone actually fell down in the newsroom one time because I scared them so bad, which I felt really bad about.
Yeah, no kidding.
But I still did it. But I still did it again. Jackie literally does not react. There is no jumping. Usually you can see someone, at least they'll shake a little bit or anything else, even if they don't scream or lash out or anything else. You know, it's been documented on this program where I've scared Christy Cameron and Patricia Bull. But Jackie just doesn't react, which is okay, that's very impressive. That
Stone cold nerves.
Just nothing.
I'm imagining she has five brothers. That's what I'm imagining.
Yeah. I don't know if you remember me telling you when I first started, because they were warning me about you and your scares. And I had said, I'm going to warn you because there are only two reactions you get from me, nothing or I punch.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's
we have to do it from far away.
Exactly. Yeah.
Physical
so,
warning.
No close scares. No close-up scares for people like that.
Scooby had been warned.
All right. Well, let us know something you do. You know it'll annoy somebody, but you do it anyway. 580-580. Tweet us at CFRA Ottawa. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is News Talk 580. CFRA.
This is News Talk 580 CFRA.